This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome, one and all, to the longest running
weekly episodic comic book podcast in all places to be nation.
I am Greg Phillips on assignment.
The jovial giant, Greg Phillips.
That's right, the jovial giant. I am on assignment in the wetlands of Florida.
Oh, I bet you are.
And that voice on the other end of the line is Nick Duke, and he is the other half of the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and he is coming to you live from Vancouver, British Columbia, in Bullshaped Studio in Hoholoon Plaza. Nick, thank you so much for flying all the way out to Vancouver without me to do the show this week.
Well, you know, it's certainly interesting. I'm sitting here, of course, podcasting pantsless, but that's really not any different than any other week that we're in the L-shaped studios. So it is what it is.
It is indeed what it is. Mm-hmm. Now, this week, folks, we are continuing Avengers Month. And frankly, any kind of follow-up to last week's going to feel like a disappointment. I mean, last week you got to hear us play a video game.
Yes.
I mean, there's not much more riveting than silence as four individuals try to remember how to play a game they played 10 years ago.
Right.
I mean, that was pretty exciting. I don't know about you, Nick, but that, to me, I was thinking the whole time, boy, this is an audio we're giving people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. High-quality audio whoop-ass for your listening enjoyment.
Absolutely. So this week, we thought, let's do one better. Instead of trying to figure out a video game that we haven't played in a decade or more, let's do a countdown of a show that we haven't watched in the better part of half a decade.
Yeah, 6 years, I think.
So what we're doing tonight is we are bringing to you, and here, let's just put all the sausage on the table. So I don't know if that's a phrase or not, but it should be. All the sausage on the table, and let's explain to the people out there that Nick and I are not what you would call Avengers experts.
No. So we caught a lot of heat earlier this year for denigrating a beloved Avengers run by Kurt Busiek and was it George Perez, I think?
George Perez,
That Avengers aficionados, hardcore Avengers fans, just love. I mean, it is beloved them. And we, you know, you and I, as something of Avengers novices, didn't really understand the appeal in terms of the storytelling anyway. So we, for Avengers Month, have been trying to reach back to our own personal experience with the Avengers. We brought you Ultimate Alliance. We're going to bring you next week a very special long book hunt on the certified best Avengers run of all time, Brian Michael Bendis' New Avengers. And this week we're going to bring you a countdown of what is, for my money anyway, the best Avengers animated show of all time, Avengers Earth's Mightiest Heroes. However, here's the problem with all that is that we haven't watched this show in, like I said earlier, about 6 years.
Yep.
We did no research in terms of rewatching any episodes
because
make this podcast.
It is not streaming anywhere that I can find.
And even if it were, we wouldn't have done any research in terms of rewatching episodes to help us craft our lists. And I got confused and thought we were doing the damn long book this week until it got time to do the show, and I found out we were doing the countdown. So we are doing this one on the, you know, by the seat of our pants on the fly, and we're just going to call out some episodes that we remember being good. And we may go back and watch them later, and they suck. I don't know. But here's what you have here is going to be our top fives as they are now.
And this is a show that both of us loved quite a bit. This
I remember I got onto it first on Netflix. When they dropped put the first season on Netflix, and I binged the whole first season, and I remember calling you like after I had seen like 8 episodes back to back one weekend or something, and telling you, you have to watch this. This is as close to Justice League and Justice League Unlimited as I have ever seen Marvel animation get. Particularly Justice League Unlimited with the expansive roster, and yet it all feeling tied together into this one central narrative. It's, to me, in terms of what I've seen from Marvel animation, it's still the masterclass of Marvel's animated output.
Yeah, we are both suckers for the long-form animated story. You know, whether it was the X-Men animated series in the 90s, but particularly perfected with Justice Unlimited and Young Justice, of the individual episodes that tie together a cohesive narrative that tells over the course of an entire season. And Avengers Earth, Mightiest Heroes was the first chance I had seen to have the Avengers be a part of that kind of a story, in animation anyway. And it was also, for me, because most of these episodes are based on classic Avengers comics, for me, it was my first exposure to most of these stories. So, you know, with that being said, the show only had 2 seasons. It was cut short and replaced by an inferior show called Avengers Assemble after its 2nd season. And it's a decision that still frustrates me to this day, Nick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was one of the unfortunate casualties of the Disney-Marvel acquisition. I believe the show had started production prior to that acquisition. And then... or maybe not. I can't remember the exact logistics of it. But I think it was... I know that it wasn't being produced in-house by Disney. And so they decided to end it in favor of bringing one in-house that they could produce themselves. So
yes. And as I understand it, they wanted one that, as they put it, felt closer in tone to the movies. Although I would argue that...
this feels closer in tone to the movies.
This feels closer in tone to the movies,
I would agree. But without any further ado...
let's get our list started.
It's not going to be a very educated countdown, so we might as well get the damn thing underway. You go ahead.
Absolutely.
You go first.
Absolutely. I'll get us started.
Yes.
With my episode.
Uh-huh.
Which is an episode titled simply Michael Korvac.
Ah, now see, in putting together my impromptu list, this was one of the ones I almost put on there but didn't.
Yes. Now, as I understand it, there is a very famous Avengers story called the Korvac saga, yes?
Yes, as I understand it as well.
I don't know anything about it. I don't know who or what a Michael Korvac is.
My very basic understanding of it is that it involved a human who was somehow imbued with a massive amount of cosmic power, and it kind of... his newfound power drives him insane.
Sounds good to me. And speaking of sounding good to me, I am currently trying to find the recap. There it is. So this episode involves a mysterious man known as Michael Korvac, who is discovered, and the Avengers must figure out exactly what happened to him, all while defending him from the team of beings who come after him, the Guardians of the Galaxy. Now, you might ask yourself, why did you put this episode on if you don't even remember the details of it? Well, as I'll say with others, I remember certain details of it. And one of those details that I remember of this episode is that it was the introduction of the Guardians of the Galaxy. And a little bit different roster from what we got in the movie. I believe the roster here was Star-Lord, Drax, Rocket, Groot, Adam Warlock, and Quasar, which is kind of a reflective of the Dan Abnett and Andy Lanning team at that time. And regardless of having Warlock and Quasar in there instead of Gamora, I thought this was a great introduction to the Guardians of the Galaxy. For me, anyway, it was probably my first time encountering them. Maybe I saw this episode after the movie. I can't remember. But I think this might have been my first exposure to the Guardians. And I thought they did a great job. You know, Star-Lord is that charismatic kind of ne'er-do-well that we know from the movies. We have, certainly Drax is not as good as he is in the movies, but it was a fun team, rock great here. I remember it being great to see the Avengers interact with another team of superheroes. When I was a kid, even though it's a played-out trope now, when I was a kid, I always marked out for the comics or the cartoon episodes where one team of heroes meets another team of heroes and they fight, before eventually realizing that they're both on the same side. I remember an X-Men episode where the X-Men encountered X-Factor, led by Havoc, and they fight in this warehouse, and it was a really cool episode. And so that was kind of how I felt about this one. The Guardians are great. The Avengers, obviously, the main cast are great. The Michael Korvac mystery was there. There's a mystery element to it. So for me, it was an episode that really came together well. I'm a sucker for cosmic Marvel in general. So for me, you combine cosmic with Guardians with, you know, the traditional kind of presentation of Earth's Mightiest Heroes and their animation style led to a really good episode that stood out in my mind, certainly enough for me to put it on my list.
Absolutely. Absolutely good to hear. Moving on to my number five, it's no secret that my two favorite characters in the Marvel Universe are Thor and Spider-Man. So for my number five episode, I'm going to go with the episode that introduced Spider-Man to this show, the episode entitled Along Came a Spider. Now, in addition to the Spider-Man stuff here, the primary reason this made my episode, because it gave me one of my favorite things in all of Marvel. It gave me a big ol' heapin' helpin' dose of J. Jonah Jameson, voiced by J.K. Simmons.
Yes.
At this point in Season 2, we had already had the Secret Invasion storyline play out that had seen America be replaced by a Skrull and take these a lot of drastic actions, a lot of very heinous actions the Skrull Captain America did. And it caused a great deal of public distrust in Captain America, who, of course, was a very notable public servant. And there is nobody better suited to dump on a public servant when they are down than J. Jonah Jameson. And we get a massive amount of this in this episode. J. Jonah continuing to take the low road at every opportunity, while Cap takes the high road at every opportunity. You have Peter Parker growing increasingly frustrated with J. Jonah Jameson's constant put downs of Captain America, even though Iron Man goes directly to the Daily Bugle to tell Jonah that the starting about Captain America isn't true, and Jonah prints it anyway because he feels like it. Just fantastic stuff. So the combination of Spider-Man jumping onto this show that I love so much anyway, with the awesome interactions between JJ and Cap, earns it the number five spot on my list.
Fantastic. Sounds like a great episode, Nick. One that I wish I remembered.
It might be. I don't know for sure.
Yes. I am excited to eventually revisit this when hopefully it comes streaming on the Disney Plus service.
You would think it would.
Now, on to my number four episode,
mm-hmm.
which is titled Some Assembly Required.
Hey, that's my painting, but it's so much my painting that I just made that I'm going to let you talk about it. You go ahead.
I'll go ahead and talk about it as my number four. Mm-hmm. This comes to us, of course, as everyone knows, from season one.
Yeah, obviously.
Of Earth's Mightiest Heroes, and it is episode 8.
Mm-hmm.
And this one, it says here, is loosely based on the Avengers number 2 and number 3.
That is accurate, yes.
And the premise of this episode, as it turns out, is that this follows a massive prison outbreak from supervillains as they're fighting the Avengers. It also shows you as a subplot Black Panther arriving in New York City, Iron Man and Pepper Potts introducing the Avengers to each other and setting up their new mansion and their new plane. They kind of are getting the business side of it going. And at the same time, the Enchantress, the famous Thor villain, the Enchantress makes her presence known by manipulating Bruce Banner to sort of whisper sweet nothings into the Hulk's mind of mm-hmm. telling the Hulk that the rest of the team suspect him.
Right.
And this leads to Hulk raging out and having a good old-fashioned knockdown, drag-out fight between the Hulk and the Avengers. Picture Age of Ultron mm-hmm. with the mind-controlled Hulk. So we get the Hulk smashing the Avengers here and them trying to smash him back. Eventually, the Enchantress's scheme is unraveled.
Right.
And the Hulk comes back to normal and joins the team and helps them defeat the Enchantress and her executioner. And things get back to normal, except the Hulk still quits the team because he decides that he can't trust the Avengers, that they were quick to attack him at the first sign of trouble. And so he goes off to the Arctic Circle to sort of lick his wounds. And that's when we get our first glimpse of Captain America's shield in the ice, as I understand it. So, certainly, this is teasing the first appearance of Captain America. This is the joining of Captain America, the unfreezing of him. This gives you the Hulk brawl with the Avengers. This is a great palate setter for the show, in my opinion, because a palate cleanser, because you kind of get an idea right from the get-go of the characterizations of all these people. You get Tony's characterization. You get Hank and Janet's characterizations here, which are really strong on the show.
Yeah, because one thing we should mention, this is the eighth episode, but the first five were standalone episodes focusing on heroes. You had a Captain America episode, a Thor episode, a Hulk episode, an Iron Man episode, and an Ant-Man and the Wasp episode. So we are, and then they had a two-parter that brought the team together for the first time. This is the first episode after they have decided to become a permanent team. Mm-hmm. So it's very important in terms of establishing the early team dynamics.
And Cap is still frozen in ice,
right?
And so it creates. And I should mention that Janet Pym became one of my favorite characters on the show. Like, the Wasp, legitimately, is one of my favorite characters on Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And it starts here with this sort of characterization of her and how she is really, you know, Hank Pym in this series is pretty much a whiny turd of a character, and Janet kind of nudges him along to do any of the good stuff that he does. So really good stuff here, and that's my number four.
Absolutely, mine as well. As you know, all the reasons that you just described the plot of, but pretty much as you'll see throughout the rest of my list, anytime we can work a lot of Asgardian stuff into an episode, I'm probably going to like it a lot. And that, of course, being the case here with Enchantress and the Executioner. And of course, bonus points for, as Greg mentioned, the heavy callbacks to very early Avengers. This storyline almost directly lifted from Avengers number 2 and number 3.
Indeed so, good sir. Well, that thought as I try to figure out which season this next episode comes to us from. It is indeed from season 2, as I suspected. My next episode, my number 3 episode, is titled Emperor Stark.
Emperor Stark, and, yeah, that's right.
Yes, Emperor Stark, and this is an episode which is sort of, I suppose, the equivalent that I would tie it into would be the Justice League episode Hereafter that introduced whatever Justice League episode it was that introduced the Justice Lords.
Mm-hmm.
Because the premise of this episode is the Vision awakens after a month of repairs to find that Tony Stark and his fellow Avengers have taken over the world. With the whole planet turned against him, the Vision must get to the bottom of Stark's utopia, only to discover an unlikely figure to be the true power behind the Avengers' throne. This is based on the 1987 Marvel graphic novel Emperor Doom. Now, obviously, Dr. Doom is involved here, but the reason this made my list is I remember just loving this, much like I did the Justice League episode of Justice League, which was kind of taking the idea of what if the Justice League just decided to rule the world with their power. And that's kind of what we get here. We get a Tony Stark who is kind of the emperor of the world. The Avengers are sort of lords and rulers of everything. They maintain order. Everybody subjugates themselves to the Avengers. They have absolute power. And I'm a sucker for those kind of stories. I love those kind of dystopian looks at our heroes and how things might be, but for a certain turn of events. And I also love that we get here through the character of Vision, somebody that can set things right and can kind of be our eyes as someone reacting to seeing these heroes act and not typically going to act. So pretty simplistic reasoning for it making my list. I just like that style of story. But that's, nonetheless, Emperor Stark makes my list at number 3.
I will have more to say on this in a few moments. But moving on to my number 3, I'm, again, if it features the Asgard, I'm probably going to like it a lot. And, You know, my love of Thor and Asgard, I will admit, it can be something of a convoluted history at times. It's a lot of exposition to get people through the introduction and the setup and the backstory you need to understand. And all these different characters and all the different dynamics that play into the royal politics and of the Asgardians. But I gotta say, this episode here, Thor the Mighty, is a pretty damn fine introduction to not just Thor, but kind of dynamics that rule Asgard during this era. Yes. because what they did for this show when they were getting ready to release it is they did a variety of what they called micro-episodes, which were little five-minute short episodes that each featured on different characters. These were released online. And then later, when it came time to debut the actual series, they took those micro-episodes and compiled them into a collection that were aired as one continuous episode. So the Thor micro-episodes were compiled here into Thor the Mighty. And what it gives us is an introduction to Thor on Earth. We get to see him fighting the Wrecking Crew. We get to see him briefly interact with Jane Foster. So you get this, you know, understanding that this is not the first time he's been to Earth. He's somewhat fond of it. And we also get to see him summoned back to Asgard. So you get that sense of dual responsibility. And there in Asgard, we see the Frost Giants storming the gates, led by Loki. Loki has turned on Asgard and is fighting his half-brother, and Thor is able to defeat him in battle. And we get to see one of the great Loki images from very early in his publishing history, where he is banished to the Isle of Silence, where he can speak no words, and he is chained to a tree and has to wait there for seemingly the rest of eternity to live out the punishment for attacking his homeworld.
Sort of like when Kevin Sullivan would tie his opponents into the Tree of Woe.
Something like that, yes. We get to see Odin, and we get to see the Odin sleep, and Odin trusting Thor to defend Asgard, and of course, Thor being Thor, not taking that responsibility seriously and heading off for Earth anyway, despite the fact that he's supposed to be there making sure Loki does not escape the Isle of Silence. And wouldn't you know it, Loki escapes the Isle of Silence, but not before he spends some time there kind of reflecting on his backstory. So this episode also gets you that introduction into who Loki is as a character, rather than just being a one-note villain. Loki escapes, the Enchantress and the Executioner help that, you know, help make that happen, and at the end of this episode, you've kind of got a great foundation for all the Asgardian stuff that they will do later in particularly season one, as I'm going to talk about in just a little bit. Asgard played such a huge role in this series, it almost feels like I was destined to love it, and that all started here in Thor the Mighty, my number three episode.
Very good reasoning, and yes, Thor has a huge role in this series, and most of the Thor episodes are really good. Number two on my list also heavily involves Thor, and his cast of characters also comes to us from season one, and the title is one that will sound familiar to Avengers fans. The title of this episode is A Day Like Any Other. And this was the season one finale of this show. And boy, it goes out with a bang. Because this, as the tagline indicates, it has all been leading to this. All of the subplots on this show, all of the loose threads throughout the season come together for this episode. And it's a knockdown dragout with the Avengers against Loki. Loki is preparing to execute Thor and all of his prisoners. And then the heroes show up to take them on. Hela shows up, and Captain America has to resist temptation and ends up coming up to help save the day with the Avengers taking on Loki. And it's a great battle between the teams. And Tony Stark shows up with his badass new armor, powered by Uru. Nick, is the metal that comprises Mjolnir.
Yes, it is the metal forged in the heart of a dying star. That comprises Mjolnir. Correct.
And that is used to create a new suit for Tony Stark. He shows up. They free Thor, take on Loki, put everything back in place, and they leave Loki kind of almost literally dying on the vine at the hands of the Midgard serpent. And they return to the mansion, and everything seems like it's put back to order. You know, the Steve is given a chance to rest after spending his time in hell, literally battling through hell. And the season ends with one of the most shocking revelations, cliffhangers of any cartoon series to end its season, and that is when Steve goes to his room and is shot and rendered unconscious by someone who looks exactly like him. That's right. At the very end, he is shot by what appears to be a Skrull, and the alien then takes his appearance and dramatically voices the words, "The infiltration has begun," mm-hmm. thus setting the stage for season two, with us as an audience knowing that Captain America is an imposter, mm-hmm. but the rest of the Avengers having no idea that their friend has been replaced. What a great cliffhanger of an ending. The entire episode I remember being great, mm-hmm. but what the reason this makes my list and makes it so high is that that is one of the great cliffhangers in all of animation for me.
Absolutely, and I'll have more to say in just a moment. But moving on to my number two, one you've already mentioned, Greg, I'm going to go with Emperor Stark. For all the reasons that you mentioned, it pretty much being the Avengers version of that Justice League Unlimited episode we couldn't actually name. The Justice Lords episode, though. It's just a...
Yes.
That take, that type, that trope of superhero storytelling is one I'm kind of a sucker for, particularly when you can wrap it up in as clean a fashion as they do here, where it kind of... It all is revealed by the end. It's not an ongoing, stretched out, you know, 8-episode arc. It's you get this alternate reality, and by the end, it's wrapped up in a very neat way. Cool usage of the Vision, having him one who is kind of tasked with figuring it all out. And heel Tony Stark just works. I mean, like, there's something about it that I'm not necessarily advocating it for it to be a long-term direction for Marvel, but man, it feels like there's a lot of potential to be mined there. So Emperor Stark is my number two.
Outstanding stuff there, Nicholas. Well, it's all come down to this, hasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
By God, it has. And what better time for me to kill time to read a summary of the number one episode than right now? Mm-hmm. Because my number one episode comes to us from the second season of the show. In particular, it is episode 23 in season two. And it is titled New Avengers.
Ah.
Now, this episode, as you might take from the title, is the introduction of a new team of Avengers.
New Avengers, in particular, pretty fair lineup, pretty decent lineup.
Yes, in particular, this lineup consists of The Thing from the Fantastic Four, mm-hmm. Luke Cage from the Heroes for Hire, as well as Danny Rand, Iron Fist, both of whom have been introduced earlier, Spider-Man, Wolverine, and War Machine. And for those who don't know, Wolverine is my favorite Marvel Comics character, voiced here by Steve Bloom, who has voiced him in a number of animated properties, including, I believe, Wolverine and the X-Men. And the premise of this episode is that Kang the Conqueror has trapped the Avengers in a temporal void and is bringing forth his armies to the 21st century. Thus, a new team must be forged, and that's where these new heroes come together to fight back Kang and his hordes. And this is just phenomenal. Like, this is to me what I love to see. As much as I love the classic Avengers, these are more characters that I grew up loving. I grew up reading Spider-Man. I grew up loving Wolverine. I always preferred War Machine in the comics to Iron Man. Again, in the comics, I always preferred War Machine to Iron Man. I always thought The Thing was by far the most interesting member of the Fantastic Four. I always thought Luke Cage and Iron Fist had a cool gimmick in the comics with the Heroes for Hire. So to me, this is like my childhood Marvel characters that I identified with getting a chance to take the spotlight. And it helps that they're written so phenomenally well. I believe this episode was written by Christopher Yost, who wrote a lot of the episodes of Earth's Mightiest Heroes. And in particular, the sort of camaraderie between these guys. Not camaraderie, because they have, you know, anybody that writes the Spider-Man and Wolverine dynamic well will have them at odds at least once or twice during the story. And in fact, there's one memorable line here where Spider-Man refers to Wolverine as his trusty sidekick. That doesn't go over well. I'm such a fan of their dynamic, and this show gets it perfect. And just getting a chance to see a new team show up and just really shake this whole show to its core, something that a lot of shows would not have had the guts to do. At the end of the episode, Iron Man makes Spider-Man a reserve member of the Avengers, along rest of the new Avengers, and you know, certainly they would show up later on. But for me, I came out of this episode, Nick, wanting to see a new Avengers spinoff out of this show, because that's how much I enjoyed this particular collection of talent and how they and how the talent got along in the locker room. Mm. Well, so for me, it was great.
Fortunately for you, you'll get something very similar to this lineup now next week's episode, as we discuss the aforementioned Brian Michael Bendis New Avengers, a.k.a. the best Avengers run of time. Moving on to my number one, it's kind of anticlimactic because you've already mentioned it, but I am going with the season one finale, A Day Unlike Any Other. Greg so expertly laid out the plot, how everything paid off, all the threads that they've been building throughout the entire season paid off so satisfactorily. But as a Thor fan, let me just run off a list of concepts here we get to see in this single episode. We get to see Frost Giants. We get to see the Fenris Wolf. We get to see the Midgardsmen. We get to see the Isle of Silence. We get to see Tony Stark in freaking Uru armor. This is Thor nerd nirvana and fan service on the highest level. Let these people do a damn Thor movie. For God's sake, whoever was in charge of this, give these people the book. Give them the pencil, as it were, when it comes to Thor's booking in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. I am all
in. You know what the most powerful weapon is?
The eraser.
In business?
The eraser. The eraser. And I'm advocating for using it on Taika Waititi.
Oh.
Here's his name as director, and we just take that old eraser and give it a little rub. That's the only rub that Taika Waititi needs, is the rub of having his name erased as director.
Why, you're saying you would like to have the MCU left with Waititi residue?
Waititiless.
Oh. Anyway, yeah, what a great episode, man. I'm glad you had it as your number one. It's one that does stand in my mind. And you mentioned, I'm glad that we also called out different aspects of it, because you talked about the bulk of the episode, which is very Asgardian heavy. And of course, I talked about the one moment that really stood out, the cliffhanger at the end, which led to a pretty compelling story arc the next season. So, yeah, really good stuff. And the one thing that I will say, now that we're done with our countdowns here, this was a pathetic effort on our part, because this is really a great show that deserved
really
more
is.
Than what we gave it.
We didn't prepare. In full disclosure, Greg's on vacation. He didn't really have time to prepare. I got confused. I genuinely thought we were doing a different episode than we were actually doing. So a confluence of factors just led to us. You know, the problem is, Greg, we just don't take this show seriously enough. I think that's proven here tonight.
I think that's obvious. And in our defense, this show really should be streaming somewhere. Like, it should be either on the Disney XD app.
Yeah, I don't understand why it's not. Yeah.
It should be on Netflix, Hulu, somewhere.
I mean,
could
you buy it, I guess, through YouTube or iTunes or something?
Certainly. But who buys actual media now? I mean, that's it's not happening from my standpoint. So, it's a shame that it's not streaming. Hopefully the Disney Plus app will have it.
You would
it's
certainly
too good
think
of a
so.
Show
yeah.
to be lost.
Man, is that Disney app? Is that Disney Plus app going to have all the Marvel animated series in history? I wonder.
I think it should.
God, we got to do something like the 90s Avengers cartoon. We got to do that at some point.
We have to give them some equal love since we did the amazing 1970s Shazam show, which
right.
whatever.
And at some point, we've got to do the long. I mean, we've teased this one out for years now. At this point, we've got to do the long teased follow up to our Spider-Man Unlimited column by continuing our delve into that series.
What, the Knights of Wondergore?
The Knights of Wondergore.
And who knows, Nick? Maybe it'll be an Iron Man 2 situation where revisiting Spider-Man Unlimited makes us realize that we gave it short shrift the first time.
Maybe we will come to sympathize with the high AF evolutionary.
You know, stranger things have happened. And who knows?
Two seasons of them, actually.
Maybe in the future, we will have a counter hard traveling fanboys. No,
maybe we will.
Well, with that being said, folks, we are going to, well, I guess we'll first tell you what we have coming your way the rest of Avengers month.
Yep.
We are going to have a Long But Hunters episode, as mentioned, on Brian Michael Bendis's new Avengers. We are also going to close the month out a cast and crew of Place to Be Nation pop all-stars as we count down the best and the worst of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. That's right. It is a giant-sized finale to our listener-recommended Hard Travelers for Hire series. This was our movie-by-movie look at the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and believe it or not, it has come to an end. And now we're going to wrap it all up, bring out a cast of all-stars here, talk about what our favorites, our least favorites are, have a little fun along the way, assuming that I make it through the rest of the next few days. So with all that being said, we're going to take a break. And when we come back on the other side, we will have information on other shows here at Place to Be Nation. We will have reading. We will have watching. We will have the rundown. And, of course, the Wrestling Minute. So stay with us. We know you will.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have over 24 podcasts available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. We now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation Wrestling feed, we dive into topics running the gamut from today's WWE to the glory days of yesteryear and the ins and outs of the territory days. In addition to our full-length shows, we also deliver to you special pod blasts on topics old and new.
The Place to Be Nation pop feed is a veritable treasure trove of great content. Offer tremendous shows covering the land of movies, television, life, comics, and sports, brought to you by the most knowledgeable and insightful folks in the podcast world.
You can find all these great shows, plus archives of our past podcasts from over the past 8 years as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while you're there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects, and much more. Be sure to support our site by using www.PlaceToBeNation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping. We want to thank our friends at Boneheads, Wing Bar, ProWrestlingOnly.com, and TheHistoryOfWrestling.com as well. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to Hard Traveling Fanboys. We are continuing our remote version of the HTF show. Nick is, of course, back in the L-shaped studio, and I am out in the wilds of Florida pursuing a wild game and surviving out here in the wilderness, having a good old time. And now we are back to give you a little bit of a message or two about the great stuff you can find right here on the feed on Place to Be Nation Pop. Because you see, we have a week on the Pop feed with a little something for everyone. Ben Morse and Russell Sellers close out 1970 on a new Marvel Age masterclass. Jennifer Smith welcomes in Todd Weber to watch Yoga Hosers in this month's Freak Out Drive-In. JT Rosero, Peter Winson, and Don Carrara pay tribute to the wonderful Veep as it winds down its run. They even got a shout-out from Julia Louis-Dreyfus for this PTBN Pop special podcast. Andy Atherton and Russell Sellers gave a look at Forgetting Sarah Marshall on this episode of Laugh in Theater. The hard-traveling fanboys head off the page with a review of Marvel Ultimate Alliance. And speaking of Nick and Greg, coming up at the end of May, the Hard Traveling Fanboys will be wrapping up their Hard Travelers for Hire series with a special giant-sized edition of the podcast. Greg and Nick will be joined by past guests for a retrospective look at the highs and lows of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and they want your opinions. After you've seen Endgame, send in your full ranking of the MCU movies from 1 to 22 to nickd@placetobenation.com. The full composite rankings for Place to Be Nation will be revealed on the show, so get your ballots in to make your voice heard. Ballots are due May 16.
Over at the PTBN Wrestling feed, Scott, JT, and John D'Amato gave a supersized deep dive into WrestleMania 5 on episode 519 of the Place to Be podcast. In the third episode of Row 1, Seat 1, Ben Zani chats with up-and-comer O'Shea Edwards and then breaks down the Making Towns Classic and the WrestleMania Weekend Blackcraft Wrestling Show. In a new Making Towns with Friends, Steve welcomes in Kelly Jean to talk about her first live wrestling experience. We continue to dive into the vault to bring you classic episodes of Where the Big Play. In this installment, Parv, Chad, and Solomon finish their look at Starrcade 1987. Check out our social media pages and message board at www.bigelow34.proboards.com for information on joining our GWWE PPV ampersand TV match ever project. Get in on the conversation today and start researching your list.
Just a flood of content here at Place to Be Nation, both on the pop and the wrestling feeds, Nick.
Absolutely. Now let's move on.
Absolutely. Now, let's move on to our weekly look at the news and notes in the world of comic books. Yes, that's right. It's a segment we like to call The Rundown.
Welcome to The Rundown.
Well, not a ton of news this week in the world of comics, but just enough for us to talk about. So, to start things off, let's talk about a rumor that we first heard about and reported on perhaps last week, which is that Michael Rooker is in talks for the role of King Shark in the Suicide Squad that is currently being written by his good buddy James Gunn. However, update, Michael Rooker is denying the Wrap's original report. That's right. In a series of Instagram posts, a social media platform that Nick and I are both quite fond of, Rooker refutes the claim.
I wouldn't know anything about what you're talking about, sir.
Rooker refutes this claim, with writer director James Gunn even chiming in to laugh. Rooker says, "This is not true news. I am not cast in this movie." Now, here's the question, Nick. Do you believe Michael Rooker? Or do you believe the Wrap?
Sadly, I believe Michael Rooker. He's been pretty good in, you know, about not intentionally misleading fans. But then again, maybe he's being technically accurate while not, you know, while not being overall accurate, if you know what I mean. Maybe he's not cast in this movie as of this moment, but that it is in the works. So let's hope that's the case. I am all in on a Blue Merle Shark, which is what he would essentially be. I don't know if he would be blue, but, you know, the point is, Blue Merle Shark would be a thing I'd be in favor of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We need to, and perhaps if he's a shark that has, you know, daddy issues with one of the other characters, that could work too.
Yeah, that would be good.
Maybe King Shark raised Idris Elba's character, you know, whoever he may be.
Or John Cena's character.
Well, one thing that no matter if we want it or not, legendary Batman creator, Green Arrow creator, DC Comics legend in the business, Neil Adams, just continues to do Batman miniseries. And in this case, he has written and drawn a brand new Batman miniseries called Batman versus Ra's al Ghul. And it is coming out this fall. Here is the synopsis. Also, apparently it ties into DC's Year of the Villain event, something I know both of us are particularly excited about. It says here that Adams shows a Gotham City under siege by terrorists, with Batman determined to find the source. But when Boston Brand, a.k.a. Deadman, tries to intervene, he discovers an even more disturbing and deadly truth. The terrorists are led by an inhuman monster. Ra's al Ghul volunteers his own private security force to aid the GCPD, and now they are the saviors standing between nuclear terror and the townspeople.
Nuclear. Now, I like the way you said that.
Yes. This is an interesting book here, Nick, because I love Neil Adams. I love his 70s output in particular.
I like Neil Adams at the time, in his proper place.
Yes.
I have not read the book, but I was at the library one day, Greg, and I picked up. It had just come out because I had the brand new hardcover in the new releases section of the library, and I picked up Batman Odyssey. Are you familiar with this?
Yes.
This production that he did a few years ago?
Yes. I haven't read it, but I've thumbed through it.
I read about the first 15 to 20 pages, and I was like, oh, my God. It was Frank Miller-level decline on display from Neil Adams, like, yeah, from what he once was. And
not just – not like, the writing is awful in these books, these modern Batman books from Neil. And I hate to say that because he's a freaking legend. He should be able to work as long as he wants to. I got no problem with that. But I also have to be honest. The writing is bad, but – I think the art even looks weird. Is it just me?
No, it's not good.
It's like this weird, like, it reminds me of the art that I would see in, like, the illustrated, remember the illustrated Bible stories books?
Yeah.
When we were kids? That's what the art reminds me of, and it's off-putting in a comic book.
Yeah, it is pretty odd. Now, he's slipped, but then again, if you have any concerns about the quality of this book that's coming out, just ask Neil Adams. He'll tell you how great it is.
He does not lack in confidence.
As Scott Van Pelt once said about, I don't recall who, he loves him some him.
Well, one company, rather, that doesn't seem to have a lot of confidence is Marvel Comics when it comes to the X-Men line. Mm-hmm. Because, stop me if you've heard this before, Nick. Mm-hmm. I know this sounds crazy. Are you ready? Marvel is canceling and relaunching the entire X-Men line.
Now, to be fair here, if you believe what he said, Jonathan Hickman actually asked for this. That he wanted the entire line canceled for the duration of his 12-week Powers of X and House of X, or excuse me, Powers of 10 and House of 10 event that's coming up. And that he wanted the new number ones to signify to people that they needed to be, they did not need to be familiar with recent X-Men continuity at all in order to jump onto the story. So,
and hey, I'm all for that, actually. I think that's a great idea. My only issue with it is, did they not just relaunch the X-Men lines not too long ago with exciting new creative teams that seemed to excite the fan base?
Yeah, and from what I understand, having not read them, but primarily listening to Russell and Tim talk about them,
yeah,
seems like they've been pretty well received.
Right, that's what I was thinking about. And then before that, there was another relaunch that wasn't as well received.
I see Bendis would have been the last major relaunch before that.
Yeah.
Because even through the renumberings and stuff, that Bendis storyline of the time-displaced X-Men kind of, that dominated the entire, like, landscape of the X-verse, I understand it anyway.
Right. Yeah, so I mean, to me, as a guy that loved the X-Men as a kid, they were my favorite Marvel characters by far. It's just overwhelming
as,
at this point.
As someone who doesn't read the X-Men and has never really had the affinity for them that I know you and other people have, I'm going to be very disappointed if the combination of Jonathan Hickman doing a long-form run and the X-Men doesn't yield the most incomprehensible, inaccessible comics of all time.
They very well might. And for the record, to be fair, because I don't want to come off as a negative Nancy on the whole thing, because I have been burned by... I have been burned to the point of not caring anymore about the X-Men over the years in the comics. But I will say, I am in favor of anything that can jettison the need to understand 45 or 50 years of continuity at this point, to try to make a cohesive narrative out of the X-Men again and a fun narrative out of the X-Men again. So I'm in favor of that. So hopefully Jonathan Hickman can pull it off. Again, like you, as you kind of hinted at there, his style hasn't always been for me. But then again, I haven't always gotten in on the ground floor on his story. So
what a bizarre text message conversation I'm having right now, by the way, with our good friend Greg Rossino, who out of nowhere texted me to ask me what my nickname used to be for former Atlanta Braves third baseman Troy Gloss, to which I, of course, responded, Santa Gloss.
Santa Gloss.
Yes.
Yes, you guys loved to hit me up with some Santa Gloss back in the day.
He would hit 210, but most of that 210 was some homers, so it was good.
He did have that one season where he was a productive member of a playoff team.
Oh, remember that playoff series they wound up losing where, like, it went to, like, the 13th inning, one of the games, and they had to put him in at third base, and he turned a damn double play.
Oh, Lord. Yeah. Yeah. Crazy stuff, man. Was that the same series where they left Kimbrel in the bullpen?
I don't remember, honestly. Because
there's so many Braves playoff losses over the years.
Rick Ankiel had the game-winning hit in that game, now that I recall. Oh,
God. Yep. Rick Ankiel.
Maybe they could call Rick Ankiel up and put him in the bullpen.
Yeah.
Better than half the scrubs they have now.
Yeah, good Lord, man. Talk about the days that I never thought that the day would come when the Braves would have a legitimately awesome lineup and a legitimately terrible rotation, or at least bullpen.
Yeah, the rotation has kind of ironed things out largely over the last few weeks, but that bullpen, man, it's feast or famine.
Well, speaking of bullpens, Nick, Marvel is known for its bullpen, right?
Yeah, and they're going to show off the bullpen right here on this story.
Absolutely. So Marvel Comics is revisiting 80 years of Marvel history with over 100 creators as part of an event called Marvel Comics 1000, an August one-shot that will celebrate the publisher's 80-year history, which kicked off in October 1939 with Marvel Comics number 1. So kind of piggybacking a little bit on Action Comics. And
say what you feel, Greg, piggybacking a little bit. I have been inundated with the hot takes from you and Todd and Russell and other vehemently pro-DC partisans on this topic. Say what you feel, Greg. Don't sugarcoat
it. No, I've got to finish reading the story because I don't know the details of it. Okay. I only know what Bleeding Cool reported, and you can't trust them with a – Well, you can't trust them all the time. Yeah, so anyway, as announced in the New York Times, Marvel Comics number 1000 will be 80 pages in length, with each page assembled by a different creative team, announced in a string of teasers. This appears to be the idea of Marvel Editor-in-Chief C.B. Cebulski, and he calls it the most complex and complicated and difficult book that he's ever had to assemble. Actually, that's according to Tom Brevoort. I'm trying to look at some of these creative teams, but they're not listed here in this article. But nonetheless, so it's an 80-page one-shot, and each page is done by a different creative team, like a series of one-page. It's not clear to me in this article, Nick, is it a series of one-page stories, or is it each page is contributing to one story that's assembled by a massive amount of creative teams?
My understanding is that it's one-page stories.
Ah, well, let me just say, while I appreciate the Action 1000 and Detective 1000 were big hits for DC, and I appreciate Marvel doing a similar story, I really don't like this approach personally, and it's not something that I'm going to invest in. Although these creative teams are amazing. I mean, you know, you remember some of these teams that were mentioned that perhaps you can help me out with, because I don't remember all the names.
I'm trying to find them.
They're incredible names. Loeb and Sale, I know, were on there. Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale. Mm-hmm. I know they were on there. And other well-known comic book creators. I think there was a... Spawn guy. Todd McFarlane. Todd McFarlane was on there, right? No?
I'm trying to pull it up. Not.
Regardless. I think it's great that Marvel's celebrating its history. I think it's an awesome idea. I just don't think the execution is the way to do it. I don't think one-page stories... not that you can't tell one-page story. I've seen it before. But, gosh, man, you got these teams. And who really wants to see Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale have one page to tell a story? You know, I would like to see them get a... Give them 10 pages in an 80-page book. Have 8 different creative teams do 8 10-page. That would be awesome.
Here are some ones that catch my eye. Jeff Loeb and Tim Sale, as you mentioned. Patrick Gleason writing and drawing one.
Yep.
Brad Meltzer and Julian Tatino-Tedesco. Ryan Stegman.
Dave Meltzer is actually getting one, as I understand it.
Oh, my God. Like our good friend Corey would not be happy about that.
No.
Jason Aaron and Goran Pavlov. Kurt Busiek and Cameron Stewart. Mm-hmm. Phil Lord and Chris Miller and Javier Rodriguez.
Mm-hmm.
Erickson is getting to write and draw one. Kelly Sue DeConnick and David Lopez. Alex Ross. Al Ewing and George Perez. Walt Simonson. Ooh. Joe Hill, Stephen King's son. There mm-hmm. are a numerous, like, they are clearly trying to sell you on creative teams.
Taboo of the Black Eyed Peas.
Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. Can he write a comic? I don't know. If it doesn't involve someone doing the Skyhook, what else are we doing?
Can you write a comic, sir? No, but I am Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Fair enough. You're on.
That'll be $12,000.
Dr. Stephen Poop even got a page.
I'm trying to pull up some more because I know I missed. I mean, like, honestly, the creative lineup, if you're just going by sheer star power, it's probably one of the greatest creative lineups ever put together. But the problem is, one-page stories inevitably are going to lend themselves to a very segmented and broken-up feel to the book, and you're going to open yourselves up to the easiest form of piracy of all time, because all you have to do is share one image, and you've seen the entire story. So, like, if I want
to
see
Twitter is going to be the place to go.
Yeah, I mean, to leak the entire book. Yeah,
we don't want to advocate piracy, but Twitter is going to have all of these pages within
Jason
moments
Latour
of this comic.
Also, is doing one
reaching pages. Great creative teams. But again,
friend of Place to Be Nation, Peter David and Adam Kubert.
I would be a fan of pairing these teams down to, I mean, hell, even if you pair it down to 10 teams doing an 8-page story each, that's more bang for your buck, in my opinion. I don't know about this. It feels like a comic book story that ruptured a disc, which
fragmented
into its spinal column.
80 pieces. J. Michael Straczynski and Ed McGuinness putting back together one of the old Thor teams from years ago.
Yeah, they did the, what was it, the Oklahoma mm-hmm. Asgard story? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jeff Lemire.
I've learned a little bit from you over the years. Jeff Lemire, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's a great, you know, and the thing is, unlike Detective or Action, I don't feel a need to buy this because, like I said, the ones I want to see, I'll just, you know, they'll be on Twitter. So I'll look at them on there.
Yep.
I'll probably read about how
it is, though. On a related note, I have not even bought Detective 1000, even though I want to. But one day.
Quite frankly, that notwithstanding, neither have I.
Yes. Quite frankly, that notwithstanding. Well, the news that I have to report here at the end here is that's the end of the rundown. Although there was one other item I did want to bring up now.
Oh, bring it up.
Springing this on you here. But I had a chance, and I don't know if you saw the same thing, But I got to watch the, and we'll count this because we usually do trailers in the rundown. I saw the trailer.
I have not seen this. I know where you're going.
For Batman Hush. Mm-hmm. Is that where you thought I was going?
No, I knew you were going there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I will refrain from saying too much since Nick hasn't watched the trailer yet. But,
I mean, the trailer. I don't care if you spoil the trailer.
Yeah. So I maintain my trepidation about it because I would prefer it to be a standalone story, if that makes sense. Where I would like it to be apart from any, and it may be for all the hell I know, but I would like it to be kind of on its own, so that you could tell the full story, Jason Todd and all of it, do the full story, but. That being said, as trepidatious as I am about it, I thought it was a really good trailer. It was edited together really well. It looks like they're including a lot of iconic parts from the comic book, and it even looks like they're animating the characters and drawing them in kind of the Jim Lee aesthetic, if that makes sense. Batman's costume looks a little bit different than we've seen in recent movies, so I'm cautiously optimistic about it. It's the movie that I'm the most invested in, animated movie, since probably, now Death and Return of Superman were awesome, but I'd already seen a Death of Superman movie before.
One of them in live action.
Right, and this kind of reminds me of the Emerald Knights movie when it came out, mm-hmm. with Green Lantern, where yeah. I was so excited and nervous about that because it was going to be adapting like straight up Green Lantern, and I knew it was not going to have to worry about an origin story, so it was just going to be straight like what I love about Green Lantern the most,
right?
And that's kind of what this is. This is such an important story to me and my comic book fandom that I want them to get it right, and hopefully they will. I do think it's going to lose something without the Jason Todd element being there, of that mystery being woven in, but I can already tell they're going to include a lot of classic moments from the comic, and I have a suspicion they may even mix up the narrative a little bit. So I'm cautiously optimistic about this now, more so than I was before the trailer.
Yeah, I having not watched the trailer, I'm of course, and you know, looking forward to it. I still am on the side of, I wish they would. Like, I understand the need for the ongoing universe or whatever, that's fine, but I really want more of those projects like The Killing Joke, where they just straight up adapted the comic, you know?
Right.
I wish that's what this was. I wish you could get a Sinestro Corps War that was like that.
Yeah.
I wish you could alternate between in-universe and out-of-universe, and when you go out-of-universe, either do something completely different or just give us a straight-up adaptation rather than trying to fit it into this larger narrative.
No, I agree with that. And I think that's kind of my trepidation about it. But again, I thought the trailer was quite good. And for me, it was enough to leave me excited about what's to come from it. And we'll see if it lives up to that, or if it annoys me and turns me off. But I will say they've had a good run lately with Death of Superman, Reign of the Supermen, so maybe they'll be able to continue that through on this one. Well, with all that being said, that brings an end to the rundown, and that brings us to our weekly segment that we call Reading and Watching. Even though we've never actually read anything heading into it. So
never, not once.
And that doesn't change this week, does it, Nick?
No.
No.
No, all my time for this week, free time this week was spent either reading the aforementioned new Avengers breakout that we're going to be covering on next week's show, or watching 1997 WWF.
Yes, yes, which, you know, and not even getting to see the great Frustrated is the GD word for it episode of Monday Night Raw. But catching the stuff that was in the follow-up of that episode. So,
you had to pick somewhere to start, Greg.
That's true. You started the night after WrestleMania 13. Mm-hmm. The lowest bought WrestleMania of all time, if I'm not mistaken.
Even lower than 11 or 12.
I believe that's the case. Now, 11, definitely lower than 12. Now, 11, I think, had a lower attendance.
Right.
Because it was in the Hartford Civic Center,
yeah.
But I think it actually had more eyes than 13.
The LT factor, I'm assuming.
Plus the lack of competition, relatively, because by 97, people were spending their money to see the NWO even run away from Sting at Uncensored.
Well, in 95, though, WCW had Hulk Hogan, right? Or not yet?
They had Hogan in 95, but WCW.
We'll get into the wrestling in the wrestling minute because it's been a massive, sure, one of the biggest days in God recent Some memory time. For wrestling. As we'll discuss later.
So yes.
Now here's your problem going to be with this watching thing. You're ahead of me. I'm sure you're caught up. You're living the live watching lifestyle now. After
I'm living the
after
live.
Years of being 48 hours behind, here you are tweeting and Twittering and sending your messages about the Arrow season finale. We're not talking about the Arrow season finale. We're talking about the damn episode from last week.
We're here to talk. We are here to talk about what the audience wants to hear about, which is the episodes that came on last week.
Last week, yes.
And so what we are here to talk about, I'm gonna need Nick's help with the vast majority of this, but I have pulled up on Wikipedia.
Oh, I got you.
I have pulled up last week's episode of Arrow to remind
me
of it.
Episode Arrow.
And what I've as you can tell from my friend's sinus problems in the microphone there, last week's episode of Arrow was one titled "Living Proof."
Oh, yeah, Living Proof.
And this picks up right where the previous episode left off, with Oliver Queen and his team buried under a bunch of rubble that was caused by an explosion set off by Oliver's...
buried under a bunch of rubble. Wonder who else was buried under a bunch of rubble one time. Must have been a pretty fair guy, pretty decent guy. Must have had a hell of a mind for this city.
Well, yes, indeed. That man who had a hell of a mind for this city does indeed pop up in this episode. It is the return of, spoiler alert, for those of you who haven't watched the episode yet, spoiler alert right now, spoiler alert, none other than Colin Donnell returned as Tommy Merlin. and Nick is recreating the Gino Hernandez story right now. So, yes, Tommy Merlin shows up in Arrow, but unfortunately for Mr. Nick over here, he did not show up as the mastermind of this season's machinations involving the Ninth Circle. He shows up as a figment of Oliver Queen's imagination, as Oliver is in such peril that he is hallucinating. And Tommy shows up as... Even though he's a voice in Oliver's head, he's very much like the old Tommy. They pick right up where they left off. They have this great camaraderie. And Tommy is trying to coach Oliver through how to, not really how to physically escape his situation, but how to emotionally and mentally escape the problem that he has with his terrorist sister, Emiko. And he really makes a lot of great points to Oliver throughout the episode, and their brotherhood shines through, even though it's not a persona, so they're not in person, so to speak.
May I just say, like,
yeah,
and she wasn't really in this episode a ton, and we haven't really, you know, it's not really related to the events, but it just strikes me. Arrow is my favorite of the CW shows, yeah, as you know, when it's on. But it can sometimes frustrate the living hell out of me, and I have to feel like the Emiko as a character has been wasted to this point, based on how great she is in the comics and how underwhelming she has been on the show to this point.
I've enjoyed her on the show. It's different for sure. Like the fact that they went with her as a straight up villain versus the more nuanced comic book version.
That's what I was about to say. Yeah, I think they've there's some nuance there because in the comic, you know, she kind of started as a villain as well, and then kind of, you know, it seems like they lost a lot of the depth from that character. To me, it
feels like she is Oliver if Oliver had gone in a different direction,
had broken bad essentially.
Yeah, and I've enjoyed that aspect of her character. However, if it makes sense, I feel like they've run out of real estate to a degree because
a while ago,
when you watch this episode, you realize there's only two episodes to go, and it feels like there's so much story left to tell with Emiko, and not a lot of time left to tell it. So, but you know, I've enjoyed her on the show, but. Nonetheless, this is for many of the people online that have been complaining about Oliver Queen kind of taking a back seat this season at times. He is almost 100% the focus in this one. He and Roy Harper are really the two focal characters in this one. And Oliver and Tommy in particular, their relationship, which was just every time he pops up, he's only popped up twice post death. I think, but every time he shows up, it just reminds me how much I want Tommy back.
He was in that crossover a couple of years ago. He was the Nazi Tommy, and then he's popped up one other time, but I can't. Oh, the 100th episode, if I remember correctly.
So. Yep, that's correct. And I really want him back on the show. I know it's probably not going to happen.
I have to imagine he will make an appearance during the final season. I would imagine we will see every character of note that has not been confirmed dead. We will probably see.
And here's the thing: there has to be a reason that they have left open the possibility of Lazarus Pits out there, other than just Roy's storyline,
right?
Which is ongoing. There is that chance anyway that they could bring Tom back through the Lazarus Pit, and because they've made it clear that there are still other ones out there. So I think that's a cool thing. So seeing Tommy was great. Roy gets a little arc here where I got to be honest. I thought for a moment they had killed him, even though he shows up in the future. So maybe he disappears.
Yeah, the way they made that up too. How does it not kill him? Like I didn't follow that. Like it seems.
No, I have no idea.
I mean, the way they described the peril they were in, it seemed like he should have been dead.
Yes, unless it was the effect of the Lazarus plus Mirakuru thing that had caused them to. Overcome whatever cure they had for his bloodlust or whatever. I don't know. I don't know. Couldn't tell you. Could not tell you. I was glad that they at least acknowledged the fact that at the end of the episode when Black Siren or not Black Siren, Black Canary decides that you know she doesn't want Roy to die, don't want him to sacrifice himself for the team, and he even says at one point, "You don't even know me," like. And I was waiting for them to acknowledge it because I was the whole episode. I was thinking, no, now to Renee and Dinah and Mr. Trivik's gone now, but to Renee and Dinah, they never even worked with Roy Harper before this last couple episodes. I honestly don't remember.
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. I think Roy came back and helped Oliver do a couple things, Oliver and Diggle, but I think that was when they were one of their divorces from the team, which should have been permanent, but nonetheless, I say that the team has been much better this year, but yeah. So anyway, I thought this was a pretty good episode, particularly the Oliver and Tommy stuff was great. You know, unfortunately it's not one of the better episodes of the season because the Roy stuff was weird and the ending left them once again at odds with the cops, which, feels like it's
played
gone,
out.
You know,
they've
played it out. It's kind of like I said about the Sarah and Ava thing over on Legends.
Right.
It's like it's one of those like just go to plot devices. That,
yeah, I agree.
You know,
but no, I like the episode as well. It just this season of Arrow has not been the follow up we kind of like pretty much since he got out of prison. The prison stuff was outstanding, and then it hasn't really. It felt like the writers didn't really know what they wanted to do after the prison storyline and have kind of been, you know.
I think Emiko's storyline had legs, especially her being a villain and all that stuff. I like the twist that they've had along the way with the Ninth Circle and all that. But, again, it feels like one of those things where you kind of run out of it's like an opposite of the Flash problem, where they don't flesh the villain out enough over the course of the season, whereas Flash stretches the villain to the point where you no longer want to see the villain.
Well, we mentioned Legends a moment ago. Why don't we move on to that?
Let's move on to Legends. Now, what was the episode of Legends, Nick? You'll have to refresh.
This involves Gary Green as All the Man We Need, as we have Gary, who is the recently evil, returned evil Gary, has returned to the Time Bureau and is setting about somehow manipulating all the various agents. And so Mona and Nora set out to stop him until Nora is placed under his spell as well. And it's up to Mona. A Mona versus Gary battle for the fate of the Time Bureau. Meanwhile, you've got Neron, who is possessed the body of Ray Palmer, and who is holding Constantine hostage, trying to get him to open a portal to hell. That's what he wants to do, so he can bring back his beloved Tabitha, who is not seen until the very end of the episode. He tricks the Legends into following him into an icy pass in Antarctica, where he drops an avalanche on them, and the time ship is stuck there. And so all the Legends are at each other's throats about what to do, how can they save Ray, if they can save Ray at all. Zari and Nate have come adoptive parents to this as-of-yet-unborn dragon, which is good, because if they tried to get rid of the dragon, they could suffer prison time in the state of Alabama. Hey-o! but, you know, there you go.
That's topical humor.
Topical humor. A little political humor for your day.
Topical insensitive humor.
Insensitive humor, yeah. So, yeah, you got all kinds of things going on. Just, Legends is, like, there's an argument to be made that Legends has become the most consistent CW show. Like, even when the episodes are bad, there is a certain level of entertainment that you're going to get from them no matter what. Like, when the shows are at their best, I still prefer Arrow and The Flash, but Legends might be the one that just hardly ever flat out strikes out. It always is going to hit a single or a double at least.
When you started to describe this episode as a Nora versus or Mona versus Gary episode, it sounded like the worst thing in the world. But here's the thing about this episode. It wasn't.
It was actually
quite good.
Yeah, it was good.
And in fact,
it's the best usage of Mona and Gary in weeks. Weeks, I say.
And A, because we didn't have to see Wolfie very much.
Mm-hmm.
And B, because really, they were kind of, to me, they were the uninteresting subplot. Right. The Constantine and Neron with Ray stuff was awesome to me. It reminded me of an 80s fantasy movie with the little creature that was there that was like really a good creature, and Constantine showing a little bit of a rare bit of Constantine showing humanity and letting down his guard and. It was great, man.
See,
and I love seeing Brandon Routh get to be a bad guy.
My favorite bit was all the Legends on the ship together, just talking. Like, Sarah and Nick having the conversation about we're the only two left. That's weird. And, like,
that was working through
their issues and stuff.
And Mick showing humanity as well, which is something we don't see a lot of, letting his guard on. So, yeah, that really, really great stuff. You know, and I thought it was a really strong week for all three shows, and that brings us to The Flash.
Right.
Tuesday night was The Flash, and what happened on this episode, Nick?
What happened on this episode?
I don't want to say anything about the finale.
They have figured out how that Cicada's plan is to disperse a metahuman virus that will kill all the metas, possibly in the entire country or even the world, and they are setting out to stop her. Nora is trying to use her mental link with Grace, the female cicada, to figure out where she is and what her plan is. All the while, you've got this backdrop of Joe West being forced to oversee the dispersal of the metahuman cure, because if the metahumans take this cure, they will be saved from the virus, the cure that, you know, Cisco has been working on all season.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the midst of all this, you've got Ralph, who is trying to put something together and, like, keep saying, hey guys, this whole Thawne thing just didn't quite fit together. And Ralph is on the cusp of figuring out Thawne's plan, and essentially everyone just goes, yeah, we don't care about that right now. Which is the most un-Barry Allen thing of all time, by the way. Like, we just spent three episodes dealing with essentially Barry's Thawne obsession and the fallout it has caused in his family. And yet, when you know, when damn Ralph is sitting there trying to go, hey man, I think Thawne planned all this. Basically, we'll just worry about it later. Like, inconsistent writing on the part of the writers, in my opinion.
He basically pulls a Burt Reynolds. Yeah, well, that's your opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I totally agree with that. So this was, to me, another an instance like Arrow. That's a little bit of a tale of two episodes, because there is the element that is not interesting, because, as it turns out, Cicada 2 also sucks.
But at least she's better than Cicada 1.
I mean, being kicked in the testicles repeatedly is better than Cicada 1. Or so I've heard. But Cicada 2 still sucks, but just as a character, not necessarily the actor. But yet, all the stuff involving the Thawne mystery, all of the stuff with Ralph and the team was great, particularly Barry is outstanding as always, and Ralph getting a big moment in that reveal at the end went a long way to redeeming it for me, because not that it was a bad episode. The Joe stuff was awesome too. Any emphasis on Joe West is good to me, but just the fact that we got to see Ralph come up with this big revelation, and it tied everything together and validated us for doubting Thawne this entire time. And by the way, means that Barry was right the whole time.
As we both said he would be. Like, can't trust this guy. You can't, there's no reason to trust.
He is the
Eobard Thawne.
Eobard Thawne is the Malcolm Merlin of The Flash.
They had him in the damn Hannibal Lecter role all season. And if you know anything, fucking Hannibal Lecter eventually killed a guy and cut his face off. Like, he didn't turn face. That's stupid.
No, everything I think he probably did come to sort of, in his way, care about Nora the same way that he came to sort of, in his way, care about Sisko in season one. Remember? Which is that he has a certain fondness for him, but that doesn't mean he's not going to rip his heart out.
Right.
Literally. So, great stuff. Thawne is the best villain, and I'll say no more than that. And, strong week for CW episodes, I thought. You know, I don't know what I would say was the best of the bunch. Maybe I'd go Legends on that. But
I would agree. Legends and then Flash and then Arrow for me, probably.
I would probably go Legends, Arrow, and Flash for the Tommy stuff.
Yeah, the Thawne stuff just carried me so much, you know, that it was...
Yes.
But in any event, I mean,
We have to prepare ourselves for next week's episode is all I'll say. Lots happening. So, with all that being said, I suppose that is the end of watching, unless you have anything else that you have. Yo, I did have viewing number 3 of Avengers Endgame.
Oh, I had viewing number 4, so there you go.
Ah, yes. And spoiler alert, so great.
It's amazing. It is... I think it's the best Marvel movie, and I don't think it's particularly close. Like, I think there is a decided gap for me between Endgame and Winter Soldier, which was my... prior to this, was my favorite.
It's one of my... it's not just my favorite Marvel movie, which is maybe a spoiler for a future episode, but it was also one of my favorite comic book, action, whatever kind of genre you want to think of, movies.
Yes, I agree with that.
It's an amazing experience. My folks loved it as well, although my mother is not too fond of Professor Hulk. Nonetheless, they loved the movie, and quite an emotional experience. So, with that being said, we'll move on from that. And right now, I am staring at a broken old clock on the wall in this room that I'm in.
The clock on the wall says 3 o'clock?
Last call for alcohol.
Mm.
And that can only mean one thing, Nick.
Mm.
That can only mean that it's time for the Wrestling Minute. Well, today, as you alluded to earlier, Nick, was one of the biggest days in wrestling in some time. As we record this podcast, today was the day that All Elite Wrestling announced that it has partnered with Turner Sports, Time Warner, and they are going to partner together to offer pro wrestling content on a weekly national cable primetime basis on TNT. AEW is coming to TNT officially in primetime in the fall. And we don't know yet the day. We don't know yet the time. But it is official that it's going to happen. Turner is also going to be supporting AEW through its Bleacher Report
Live. BR Live, which is their streaming
app. BR Live streaming app. And this is really the formalization. And through the press release, which is, I had known my way around a press release by this point, the press release indicates a strong level of corporate support from Turner for AEW. I don't know what that means in terms of finances. I don't know who's paying for what. All that I know is a weekly TNT wrestling show is a big deal. A very big deal.
It's a massive deal. Like, it is instantly. Let's go back 18 years to when WWE bought WCW. Since that time, there have been various other promotions that have popped up that have purported to be that true alternative. Whether it's Hey, whether it's Ring of Honor, whether it's New Japan with their United States expansion, whether it is, oh God, what was it, World Wrestling All-Stars, which I think was kind of the first one to get on pay-per-view after the sale. None of them have been able to land a consistent televised presence on the level of this deal. Now, yes, I know TNA at one point had the Spike TV deal, which you have to remember, at that point in its history, Spike TV was declining in carriage. I mean, they had to change, they rebranded the Paramount Network because Spike TV in the last 5 to 6 years of that brand was a dying brand. There's a reason.
Yes, WWE, once they lost the UFC, Spike declined precipitously.
Yes. TNT, consequently, you know, by comparison, is arguably a stronger and more established television network now than it ever was when WCW was on the air. TNT is taking great strides in both live sports programming and original content, and it now viewed as one of the cornerstones of most cable packages in a way that it perhaps wasn't, you know, 20 to 25 years ago. This is a huge deal. I don't think it is overstating it to say, I think today is the first day in 18 years that WWE has had legitimate competition.
Yeah, I mean, this is, look, it's never going to be like it was. It's not going to be like 1997 or, you know, 10 million people are watching pro wrestling on a weekly basis. But what it is going to do is it's going to provide a huge audience to access to pro wrestling, and perhaps some people that maybe have not tried to watch the WWE or have tried it and it's not for them. And it's going to give them a chance to watch something else. And it probably will also give some of these millions of people that have tuned out of WWE just in the last couple of years something that they might be interested in watching. And again, competition is a wonderful thing in the world of pro wrestling. Because, look, none of us are suggesting that WWE is going to go out of business. They're fine. In terms of business, none of us are suggesting that we want WWE to go out of business or to struggle. What we want is we want WWE to be good.
To feel the pressure.
And WWE historically is at its best when it feels pressure, when it feels pressured by something or someone, whether it was the UFC at one point, whether it was WCW, whether it was Crockett in the 80s. That's when WWE has been at its best. And, by the way, we also want another great wrestling product in AEW. Mm-hmm. And whether it will be or not remains to be seen. But certainly the building blocks are there. And, you know, as a wrestling fan, we should all be supporting both of these companies to do well.
Yes.
And again, the more places for the boys and the girls to make money in the business, the better. And yeah, I'm excited about this, man. This is really, really cool.
The one thing I'll say, they've got to figure out their streaming pricing. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the market for it is higher than I believe. But like, I do not think there is a sizable pay-per-view market for professional wrestling at $50 a show in 2019.
I'm the same way. Not when WWE Network gives you everything you could want for $10 a month.
And yeah, even if they increase the price, not when WWE is going to give you everything they've ever produced for $15 a month. Even like you can't expect people to look at those two investments and compare them favorably. So
right,
I'm not saying you have to adopt WWE's model, subscription based model. Like
no.
It's just you can't expect.
Maybe pay-per-view you can still do, but you have to look at that price point because, again, we talked about how TNT probably is in a higher profile role now than it was back then, but there's also far more competition now than there was back then for your dollar. Not in terms of wrestling, but in terms of the average consumer's dollar and time, there's so much more competition now. Everybody's got a streaming service that people are now paying for. You've got boxing, you've got the UFC, you've got wrestling, you've got you've got live sporting events, you've got so many different things that people are paying money for right now that they didn't have the option to do back in the day. So, you've got to find a way to, unless we don't even know what their model is going to be. Maybe they won't even have a pay-per-view event model. Maybe they will simply use the weekly television show as their primary platform. I don't know. It may be a different philosophy. We just have to, and maybe they do like a quarterly big show.
And the one,
I don't know.
The other thing I'll say is I think I'm not going to say it's dead, but if I were New Japan, I would be heavily reconsidering this expansion at this point. I do not think the professional wrestling market in North America has proven that there is space for a third legitimate option. And it's been that way since 2000.
I would also heavily reconsider the Ring of Honor partnership.
Yes.
If I were them.
An AEW partnership at this point for New Japan would do wonders
in the world
to get their talent on national TNT exposure.
But, yep. Be great for their talent. Be great for the industry. I don't want to single out the brand because I don't watch their products enough, and they've got a lot of great talent and a lot of great matches. But I was just earlier today, I'm down here in Florida, as I mentioned, visiting family, and just actually right before we recorded this podcast, I was watching the Ring of Honor television product, and man, it feels like a totally different company than it did 8 months ago. Much less 3-4 years ago. The talent level is just so different now, and the divide in the top level talent and the mid card and low card talent, it comes off a lot to me. The product came off a lot more indie, and not in the best way I was watching it. So
Ring of Honor's
thing,
see
the benefit
has got to be at this point. They've got to hold on because
yes.
Sinclair just acquired all the old Fox Sports regional networks that Disney was forced to divest themselves of as a part of the Fox-Disney merger. So Sinclair, in theory, is now going to have all these regional sports networks that they can promote Ring of Honor on and put Ring of Honor on. Now, I don't know when that deal closes or when Sinclair takes over programming for those networks, but Ring of Honor needs to hold on for that. And you would think that's at least a boost in terms of viewership, in terms of exposure, in terms of advertising revenue. Mm-hmm. But you got to make it there.
And Sinclair's got to invest the time and the money into it. Because there is good talent in Ring of Honor. I mean, Kenny King cut a great promo on this episode that I watched. He was really good, and there's talented guys on the roster. But honestly, I didn't know who half of them were, and a lot of the other ones on there came off local indie gimmicks, like the Bouncers, which are two enormous fat guys that look like guys that I could see wrestling in Dothan on a given weekend. It just didn't seem like Ring of Honor to me, if that makes sense. Like it felt like a local indie, and I don't know. I feel like Ring of Honor maybe has lost its identity a little bit. I'm not sure they really know what they are right now, and need to kind of refocus and figure that out.
That's kind of been a hallmark of the Sinclair era, though. If you look back
at
it. And again, maybe Sinclair has to look at Ring of Honor and realize what we were saying a minute ago is there really room for a high-profile third-place wrestling company in the United States? Because I think before Show 1 has aired on TNT, you've been passed by AEW in terms of profile and profitability.
And you compare it to something like PWG, which has stayed in its lane the entire time that it's been an organization. Mm-hmm. They have never tried to expand, and by all indications, they're still doing outstanding for what they are. Mm-hmm. And then you've got Impact, which is somehow holding on with their limited television exposure, and having good matches and stuff like that.
But Impact, I forgot they even existed.
Most people have, I feel, and even though there's good matches and, again, really good talent on their roster, as there always has been, by the way, in Impact, don't let anybody tell you different, the problem has always been in the presentation, and, they're barely hanging on by a string, so.
And then you've got MLW, who is trying desperately to get in the game as well, so it's.
And MLW has a good product. It's.
I tell just, you what, again, man, that damn, which, I don't even know what you call it, but that damn updated version of the heart attack that.
Oh my God!
That,
I know
that Teddy Hart and Davey Jr. Are doing. Good Lord!
Yeah, their matches. I don't. Pentagon.
I don't accurately. I couldn't even tell you what to call a damn move. I couldn't describe it to you. All I know is it looks like something the Steiners would do to a damn Japanese jobber from back in the early 90s.
Yes, the Steiners and Japanese jobbers. My favorite combination. Yes, it is reminiscent of that. So yeah, plus you've got Jim Cat screaming about stuff on commentary. It's good stuff. So
goddamn Stanislav Zbysko. Motherfucker.
And we should mention, folks, that's a good time to mention that unfortunately good old JR could not be with us this week.
Yeah, he is on vacation as well.
That's right. The white meat babyface jumping Jim Ross. Has just launched his own new podcast alongside Connie, my boy, Thompson.
And then he also had a busy day. He has to be at the upfronts, the Warner Media upfronts today with the AEW news. So he's just had a busy time and couldn't carve any time out for us. But we'll make sure to have something extra special for his return next week.
That we would especially like to apologize to the two or three people on Twitter that listen to us only for the Jim Ross portion.
At Rebel Life Media. Yeah, and at Twerk Flicks, which is still remarkable that's a follower of ours, but I'm not gonna be upset about it. I'm gonna accept it. We're sorry we don't have any Jim Ross for you this week, but we will be back next week.
We will give you something special next week. And speaking of Twerk Flicks, Nick, you know I was at the beach today here in sunny Florida. And, wow.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So, with that being said, folks, we're gonna call it a night on this one. And we do invite you, of course, to send your feedback on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. Of course, our email address is, please, I will reemphasize this from earlier in the show, please get us your ballots for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's probably too late
by the time this comes out, you probably have missed that. So be sure to tune in a couple weeks for our giant-size retrospective look back at the MCU and check that out as we're going to reveal the results of that composite ballot. And also, you know, if there was anything on the show tonight that you may have noticed that we did differently and you might have preferred it another way, let us know that too.
Yeah, and please send it to us digitally so that we can screenshot it, if possible. And with that being said, we are going to call it a night on this one.
Yes,
we hope you tune in next week. Assuming there is a next week, we are the Hard Traveling Fanboys, and you all have a good one.
Hard Traveling Fanboys. Hard traveling fanboys, 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 hard traveling fanboys.